a flask. Oh my god, I've just knocked a water bottle over.
Should leave that in.
If our universe is expanding, does this mean that there is a centre?
Further out into our universe we look, we're looking further back in time, in effect.
It raises more questions like, well, if the universe began, can it end?
Hello, welcome to the Supermassive podcast from the Royal Astronomical Society. With me, science journalist Izzy Clark and astrophysicist Dr. Becky Smethurst.
And we're kicking off the new year with the beginning of everything, the Big Bang.
That's right. And come December, we'll explore how the universe might end if it hasn't already happened by then. Happy New Year, everyone. Not only is it a new year, but also the Supermassive podcast is a year old. Happy birthday to us.
Happy birthday. Our baby's gotten so big.
You brought birthday cake, right?
I didn't, but I'm definitely using that as an excuse later to eat some cake. It's so weird, though, to think that like a year ago, we recorded our first episode in that beautiful room in the RAS, like, you know, the council room with all the books everywhere. I wanted to be like Belle from Beauty and the Beast, just sort of swinging around, didn't I? But like that was one of the only of the two episodes we did in person, and we've been doing them from home since.
I know, it's been a weird year, but here we are with episode 13. And as always, we're joined by Robert Massey, the Deputy Director of the Royal Astronomical Society. So is the Big Bang a misleading name for the beginning of our universe?
Well, it is really, because it wasn't a bang as such, and a big bang implies this expansion into something. It's more of a sort of headlong rush where the kind of size of the very size of space and the universe expanded outwards rapidly and continues to do so to this day. And we can't even really adequately explain the very start because the physics isn't up to it yet. It's also worth noting that Fred Hoyle, who really hated the theory, he called it the Big Bang as a derogatory term, and then it got adopted. He had this idea that there was what was called a steady state and matter was being created to fill the gaps as the universe expanded, which of course, you know, may sound completely ridiculous, but then in the context of the time, you know, you only had to create a few atoms a year, so we should be a bit forgiving, I guess, about the people who were skeptical at the start. But yeah, Big Bang, I think we're stuck with it. I mean, what are we going to call it? You know, the sort of the gentle expansion, or the, you know, or the everywhere stretch. That would be the one.
Well, it's funny that you say that, because Enigma Dave on Twitter says one of the few things we can say with certainty is that there was no bang. So I guess this is a question for everyone. We've had headlong rush as one. If you could rename the start of all of this, what would you choose to call it?
I've heard people call it the cosmic egg, which I kind of like, because like an egg hatches and then this thing comes out and then you've already got all of the stuff you need to make like a bird or a chicken, right? Like, and it kind of is analogous to the Big Bang. So cosmic egg.
I think it needs to be a cosmic egg at sort of a time lapse high speed, really,
yeah,
doesn't it?
You know? I think we should go for something just even more confusing, like super hipster alternative, like the event, and then no one just really explains what it is and you just like accept that it's a thing and move on.
So what we would really do if we were proper astrophysicists, Izzy, is we'd come up with a name for it, and that, like the event, and then we'd fit the most obscure acronym we possibly could to those letters.
Yeah, that's what our listeners can do. You can message in and find something that will squeeze into that.
Cheers, Robert. Anyway, we'll be catching up with you later in the show for some more stargazing.
So to quote the theme tune from the Big Bang Theory, at the beginning, our
whole universe was in a hot, dead state.
it's actually impossible to not do that. But the words are, our whole universe was in a hot, dense state. The Big Bang model describes how all this started from when the universe was incredibly small. It's not just matter and energy we're talking about here. It's literally space and time being created in the Big Bang and expanding to give us our ever-growing universe.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to picture it not as a sort of single point in space that expanded outwards like you would like a typical explosion. But the Big Bang just, it wasn't explosion at all. You know, if we go back the 13.8 billion years back to the very beginning, everything that is currently in the universe now was still there. It was just a lot smaller. It was incredibly, incredibly dense that it was compacted down to. You know, it's just been stretched outward since then. It's like a bobble or an elastic band, something like that, right? Where you can stretch it and stretch it and stretch it, but you don't create any new elastic band in the process, right? You still have what you started with. And the Big Bang is something like that, but still, as people picture it in their heads, they picture this point, you know, somewhere. But that's the thing, because space was created in the Big Bang, and because time was created in the Big Bang, there was no before the Big Bang, and there's no place where something could be, because space hadn't been created yet. So, it's a lot to wrap your head around.
Yeah, well, to help unravel this mystery a little bit more, I spoke with Professor David Wands from the University of Portsmouth, and started by asking him if we know what kicked things off 13.8 billion years ago.
What caused our universe to begin? Really, how the universe begins, that instant, that is the limit of our knowledge. So I can't tell you how the universe began right at that instant. What we can tell, you know, what we can describe is how the universe, from this ultra-hot state, expanded and cooled. We know a lot about fundamental physical processes up to high energies that we can test on Earth. And that really can take us through from the first fraction of a second after the hot Big Bang through the next 14 billion years. We then think we understand most of the physical processes, the key physical processes at work.
Right. So the very beginning, what kicked it all off is still a bit of a question mark. But from a fraction of a second afterwards, we know what was going on. So what was it like? What was going on?
Well, in the first fraction of a second after the Big Bang, we have a real dense soup of elementary particles. But we can't see directly into that very early time because all these particles are scattering off one another. So light doesn't escape from that hot, dense plasma. The temperature is something like 10 billion degrees. And at that time, what you're seeing is nuclear physics at work. You have a plasma of hot charged particles, and so we see processes of nuclear fusion going on in the early universe. 3 minutes after the Big Bang, that's the period at which protons and neutrons can combine to form some of the light atomic nuclei, so nuclei such as helium or deuterium.
So just after 3 minutes, it's so hot that we're seeing this nuclear fusion, and these are the processes that go on within our own sun. So this is the beginning of us getting elements, essentially.
Yes, that's right. It's the formation of the first elements. It's only the lightest elements that can form in this way. And indeed, we know that heavy elements, more complicated elements, so carbon, oxygen, even ultimately iron and gold and the heavy metals, form much later in stars.
Okay, so that takes us up to 3 minutes. What happens after that point?
Well, the universe continues to expand and cool, and perhaps the next major landmark moment is when those charged atomic nuclei, protons, which become hydrogen or the helium nuclei, combine with electrons. And that's now at the energy levels of atomic physics. The temperature's dropped to just 3,000 Kelvin or so, and that would be after about 370,000 years. So we've got a very clear timeline of when these processes happen.
So we've gone from 3 minutes to 370,000 years. quite a wait.
That's right. So the universe cools in this very orderly fashion. But after 370,000 years, the electrons and protons combine to form neutral atoms. Because they're neutral, they don't interact strongly with the photons, with the light. And so the universe becomes transparent. And instead, we see the light from that recombination of the electrons and protons. But further out into our universe we look, we're looking further back in time, in effect, and we see that the universe is different. At great distances from us, we discover, you know, galaxies appear younger, and eventually we can actually see light from this hot thermal Big Bang. We actually see today relic radiation from that time, and that's what we call the cosmic microwave background radiation.
I think a big question that always springs to mind is, how can something, and by something I mean our universe, begin from nothing? Like, how can something just start?
Well, I think, like most physicists, I think there must be more than the simple Big Bang model that I've spoken about so far, because it's singular. It really is incomplete. So there's a lot of research going on currently to understand how we could describe that emergence of the universe within our physical theories. But we know we have to go beyond the current standard model of particle physics. There has to be something more than we currently have in the standard model of particle physics.
Professor David Wands from the University of Portsmouth. Now, Becky, how exactly do we know that this is how our universe began?
Yeah, I mean, it's literally a little bit of cosmic archaeology, if you will. You're sort of looking at all of the clues and evidence and bits of fossil almost that our universe gives us that's left over from this time. So the fact that light takes time to travel to us, it has this speed limit of 30 million meters per second, right? It means that we can see almost back in time as we look further back through the universe, and we can see how things have evolved and come to grow to, you know, to the galaxies we see now. We also see this cosmic microwave background, this echo in microwave or radio waves that we see from every single point in space that comes from this heat left over from the Big Bang that's now cooled. And essentially with all those observations, you then come up with this model, this theory that if you extrapolate back from what we see now, what did we have in the beginning? And from that beginning, can it explain everything we see now? And so that's how we end up with this model of the Big Bang.
And if our universe is expanding, does this mean that there is a center?
No. And again, this comes back to this idea of trying to picture the Big Bang as starting from somewhere in space.
But exactly, yeah.
The Big Bang was everywhere because space was created. So the Big Bang's, you know, right next to your ear right now. It could be where the Big Bang happened. And the universe obviously is expanding and growing from there as well. I guess the question is really whether the universe is infinite or not, right? Because if it is infinite, then it doesn't really have a center. But if it isn't and it has some size and some shape or geometry, then technically you could have a geometric center, right? But that would be meaningless. It wouldn't be that, you know, something had happened there or it'd be anywhere special. There is, however, the center of the observable universe. And the center of the observable universe is you, right? Not you necessarily,
obviously.
Izzy. Don't get too big-headed or anything.
I think you'll find that it is.
It's you observing the universe, like whoever you are, right? Because of this idea that light takes time to travel to us, there is actually the furthest that we could possibly see. And that is, you know, however old the universe is, back, sort of the furthest thing we can see. And so that means that as soon as you observe the universe, you know, when you look out in any single direction, you can only see that far. So you are at the very center of this sort of spherical observable universe that you can see. So I quite like that idea.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess that comes to, like, you know, your point of reference and viewing the universe like that.
Yeah, exactly.
And so why is the idea of our universe starting in this infinitely dense state so important? I mean, where does all of this stuff come from?
It's funny that saying, where did it come from? It was already there. Like, you know, to have an infinitely dense state, you have to have a huge amount of material, right? Everything that's in the universe now was in that point, just infinitely small. And this is what we call this singularity, you know, and people might have heard of this term in reference to black holes, right? This infinitely dense point. And that's really how we describe it mathematically, right? And it's what actually Roger Penrose won his Nobel Prize for just back in 2020, you know, with his work and with his work where with Stephen Hawking, showing that these singularities aren't just these mathematical curiosities that make mathematicians happy about dividing by zero. They're, you know, actual sort of inevitabilities in nature as well. And it's really important because it shows that, you know, our universe isn't endless or eternal, that some thought or might have hoped in the early 20th century, as we'll hear in a minute. And it also, it raises more questions like, well, if the universe began, can it end? And if it will end, then how will it end? And perhaps could then, you know, the Big Bang happen again? Is it perhaps cyclical that we go through, you know, Big Bangs and the opposite, like a big crunch or something, you know, over and over again, you know, endlessly perhaps, you know, perhaps it is endless in the end. And this is why I say that, you know, there's so much that we don't know than we do know. Yes, okay, we've got this fantastic model of the Big Bang that explains these observations of the universe we make, but it almost raises more questions than it answers. Now, it can take a while to wrap your head around how our universe began and that it's expanding. Trust me, I've spent a fair number of years trying to do just that. But imagine being the person to first figure this out and then having to convince other people of your way of thinking. Now, the Big Bang was a theory that reshaped how we saw and understood our universe. And throughout the 20th century, it was the source of much debate among scientists. To tell us more about this is Professor Thomas Hertog from the University of Leuven in Belgium. All right, Thomas, let's start us off now. Who first came up with the idea of the Big Bang? Who first hypothesized it? And when was this?
This was sort of a two-step process. The very first suggestion came from a Russian astronomer, Alexander Friedman, in 1923 or 24. But he thought about that purely as a mathematical exercise. He didn't really think that our universe had a Big Bang. And incidentally, he was working with Einstein's new theory of gravity, and Einstein himself completely dismissed Friedman's suggestion. But then the idea resurfaced a couple of years later in 1927, and that was by a Belgian astronomer, Georges Lemaître. So he was a priest and an astronomer, and he was also working with Einstein's theory. And he went further than Friedman. He really suggested physically that our actual universe was expanding and therefore had an origin in what he called a primeval atom. And that was the first suggestion, 1927, 1928.
And so, what did he do with that information? Like, what, you have that idea, then what did Georges Lemaître do with that?
Right. So he wrote a paper, as we do, and he published that paper in a French journal. Now, in the fall of 1927, Einstein was in Belgium, and Lemaître tried to meet up with him. And in fact, he got himself into a taxi with Einstein. And then he asked about it, like, look, I have this new theory about the universe, and it's based on your new relativity theory of gravity, and I think the universe expands. So Lemaître really predicted the expansion. Now, Einstein, of course, he remembered this business from Friedman a couple of years earlier, and he said, well, look, that's nonsense. I know the theory admits this possibility, but physically, he said to Lemaître, this is abominable. Let's not think about it.
Goodness, so then what happens? You know, whilst, well, you know, you don't really want to say, sorry, Einstein, I'm continuing with my theory.
Yeah, so that's what...
What did he do with
that's
that?
What, basically, that's what he did. So it's a very curious situation. In 1928 and 29, you basically had one person on the entire planet who was thinking he was living in an expanding universe, and that was Lemaître. And so there are graphs which are preserved in the archives of Lemaître, which show him solving Einstein's theory and getting all sorts of expanding universes. Now, Lemaître also sent his paper to Eddington in the UK, right? But for some reason, Eddington didn't pick up on it. So I think it's important to point out that it's not just because it was in a French journal that this thing did not come true, because French was, together with German and English, a fairly common language to publish scientific results in those days. I think the real reason, and this shines true from the conversation between Einstein and Lemaître, the real reason is that the scientific community wasn't ready for this bold new idea. Because, as you were saying earlier, I mean, if you come to think about it, it's really strange, right? It's really strange that the Earth is 4 billion years old. And essentially what Lemaître was saying was that a little bit before that, there was no universe. It's really, really strange. But that's what he was saying.
And was anyone else in the field working on a similar idea, or was he quite alone in this idea of an expanding universe?
Well, that's a very good question. He was alone in this idea, but in 1929, there was an observer, Edwin Hubble, who was working with what was then the biggest telescope in the world in California, near Los Angeles. And Hubble was observing that the distant galaxies, so the other galaxies other than the Milky Way, that those distant galaxies were moving away from us. And the further he was looking, the faster they were moving away from us. Now, Hubble was not interpreting this observation as an indication for an expanding universe. He was just looking at it and seeing, this is like the Doppler effect, like when an ambulance moves away from us, the sound goes down. Similarly, the light of these distant galaxies shifted to the red because they're moving away from us. But of course, Hubble's observations caught the attention of people like Eddington. And there was a very famous meeting on January the 10th of 1930 at the Royal Astronomical Society, at which Eddington explicitly put on the table the question like, look, guys, there is a problem here. All these galaxies are moving away from us. If Einstein's theory is correct and applies to the universe as a whole, it better explains this. Now, Lemaître was not at that meeting, but in those days, the report of those meetings was published. And so the next month, he receives his copy of the observatory in Leuven, and he said, what? Eddington is asking this question. I solved this question. And so at that point, Lemaître wrote a letter to Eddington and sent again his paper, telling him, one, I sent this to you before, and two, I also spoke about it with Einstein, but he didn't agree. And three, please read it again. It solves your question. And so at that point, this was the game changer. Eddington was extremely enthusiastic about it. He invited Lemaître to publish a translation of Lemaître's paper in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society. And the point is that in the 1927 paper, Lemaître already predicts that if we are living in an expanding universe, which Einstein's theory suggests, then we should see that the distant galaxies move away from us. That's the indication. So the whole circle closed 1930,
31. Yeah. And it's a nice little neat thing that he actually predicted before Hubble even observed it. But it's funny, isn't it, how, you know, we think of something that's a bit like the Big Bang as just so scientifically and universally accepted, but there was so much debate for so long, wasn't there? What was the turning point at which the Big Bang became the accepted theory?
Yeah, you're right. This took decades and decades. Fred Hoyle, the famous British astronomer, for instance, was very much against Big Bang cosmology. He invented the name Big Bang to make fun of Lemaître's theory. And he also did not miss any occasion to point out that Lemaître was a priest and that he had a religious agenda. And so, strangely enough, even in the 50s, Big Bang cosmology was out of fashion. It was not the dominant model. Hoyle had another solution. Hoyle said, look, it's okay, the galaxies, you're right, the galaxies are moving away from us, but in the voids, in the empty space that they leave behind, constantly new galaxies emerge and are being born. And so overall, he said, the universe is just static and eternal and in a steady state. But then the real game changer came in 1964 when radio engineers at Bell Labs in the United States observed a faint echo of heat radiation. And this was precisely the unique prediction of Big Bang cosmology. If the universe was small and hot at very early times, it must have radiated. It must be filled with heat. That heat has cooled now, but it hasn't disappeared. And so there was, at that point, that was really the, one can say, the shot heard around the world, right? That was when it all changed.
Okay, and so that's the cosmic microwave background, which was discovered in 1964. So was Lemaître still alive to see this happen and unravel before everyone?
Oh, that is an amazing story. Lemaître fell ill in 1962. And so he was by then out of touch with the scientific community. But his successor, really, went to bring him the news on his deathbed. And so Lemaître heard 3 days before he died about the discovery of the cosmic microwave background, which proved his theory right.
Wow.
And so that's what he said. Eh? So, I'm happy. Now we finally know.
Wow, that's a luxury that hasn't been afforded to many scientists,
no,
is it?
That's
so
right.
I never heard that. I'm so glad to have heard that today. Thank you so much, Thomas, for talking us through that. That was great.
You're very welcome.
This is the Supermassive podcast from the Royal Astronomical Society with me, astrophysicist Dr. Becky Smethurst, and with science journalist Izzy Clark.
We're starting the year with a look at how the universe began. But before we get to your questions, I ended up down a little rabbit hole recently, and I thought you might like to know, Becky, that we are big in India.
In India? Yeah. Hello, India!
We're the number one astronomy podcast in India. I'm obviously going to try and not let that go to my head.
That's amazing, though. Like, it's just, you know, you just want to say thanks for all the support, right? I think it's still crazy that we're recording this from our, you know, spare rooms when we're all housebound in lockdown, and yet we're somehow reaching people, like, across the world. That's amazing.
And not only that, we're in the top 10 astronomy podcasts in France, Russia, New Zealand, Australia, Finland, and Singapore.
Well, so. New Zealand is what I got from that. And I'm like, well, that means Jacinda Ardern, number one fan of science communicators in general, is definitely listening.
New BFF, add her to the list. But I think we're basically ready for a world tour now. I mean,
oh,
COVID's obviously delayed that, but we'll work on it as soon as we're out of lockdown. But honestly, though, we started this podcast last year to celebrate the Royal Astronomical Society's 200-year anniversary. And across the year, we have had more listeners than we ever imagined. So thank you so much. And, you know, in true podcast style, if you are enjoying it, then please rate and review the podcast, because who knows, then we can be big in Canada.
I do love Canada.
Yeah, next one on the world tour. But we've had some brilliant questions sent in this month for both you and Robert. So let's get to it. Becky, Glyn Davis asks, assuming that immediately after the Big Bang, nothing could have had mass, how long after the Big Bang was it that something developed mass?
Good question, Glyn. I feel like that's a question better directed to a particle physicist and not an astrophysicist like me. But, you know, if Brian Cox can do it, then I'll give it a go, because he's technically a particle physicist that talks about astrophysics all the time. So I think what Glyn's talking about is that a trillionth of a second after the Big Bang, or after expansion starts, if you will, nothing had mass before that, okay? And it's all due to the Higgs boson, or the Higgs field all of a sudden kicking in, essentially. So before that, nothing had any mass, and so they were moving at the speed of light. But after that, the universe had cooled enough that the Higgs boson essentially takes charge, right? And then gives particle mass. And I've had the Higgs boson described to me as like trying to walk through sort of 2 foot of snow, right? And that resistance of you trying to walk through that is what gives particles mass, as they move through what's called this Higgs field, right? And it sort of slows them down, and so they don't travel at the speed of light anymore. So to answer your question, Glyn, it was a trillionth of a second after the Big Bang is when the Higgs boson was like, right, guys, let's chill out now. We're all going to start having mass.
I love these questions. We're really getting into it this month. So Robert, Peter from South Australia asks, was it a Big Bang or just the other side of a black hole ejecting all that it devoured? You know, just
yeah,
that.
I love these straightforward questions that no way are complicated to answer. I particularly like this quote. I was trying to look up this one, and I found a quote from a Nature article in 2013, which says, and I quote, "For all physicists know, dragons could have come flying out of the singularity," which kind of summarizes some of the speculation about this stuff. However, I will try to answer it more sensibly. It is a serious idea that instead of just the kind of Big Bang model we think about, there is this idea that you can have a black hole forming in another universe, like a mother universe, and then a daughter universe, i.e. one like our own, forming inside that. And that in this very strange way, you're basically disconnected from it in any meaningful sense. You can't travel between the two, at least in no conceptual way we can think of. But you can imagine a whole network, a multiverse, multiple universes all connected in that way. So as crazy as that sounds, actually, there is something. There are people looking at it as an idea. I don't feel remotely qualified to comment on the merits of the idea, I have to say. But it is, you know, it's a real thing. There are people who think about that idea that, you know, maybe mother universes everywhere spawn daughter universes inside black holes.
My brain just instantly took me to Inception.
I just love the idea of the dragons flying out. How can we?
Here be dragons. No, but this is legit though, right? This is actually, I mean, I say legit, like, again, probably not qualified enough to comment as a, like, not a cosmologist on how, you know, seriously this is taken, but it has a name, so I feel like that means it's taken seriously. It's called, like, black hole cosmology. And when Peter was asking about the other side of a black hole, you know, that's a bit more sort of wormhole and sci-fi. I think what he possibly means is the opposite of a black hole, which is a white hole. And that's another idea that's been raised as well, is that actually the universe could have been a white hole that, you know, spawned everything. And when I say white hole, right, so if we think about a black hole, and we think about all paths eventually in the future will lead you to that singularity at the center of the black hole. So another way of saying that is literally the singularity is in the future. A white hole is the sort of time opposite of a black hole. So instead of the singularity being in the future and you're always going to end up there, the singularity is in the past and everything's coming out of it. And so for the idea of the universe and the Big Bang to have actually been a white hole, there's obviously a couple of things that you would then see in the universe. One of the things you wouldn't see is that the universe would be homogeneous and isotropic, as we say. So it looks the same in every single direction. That wouldn't be something you would see if the universe started in a white hole. But because we do see it, when people are like, oh, well, that obviously can't be the case. But the thing is, we talked about this idea of the observable universe. We can't actually see anything beyond where we're not getting light from it. So it could be that outside the observable universe, stuff isn't looking all the same in every single direction. And so then if you just, you know, just ignore homogeneity and isotropicness, then actually the model of a white hole works. And you can sort of picture it as, you know, when a star sort of collapses down, it's like the opposite of that. It's sort of watching that in reverse and mathematically modeling that, there's absolutely no problem with it. And it gives you the same thing that our current sort of best model of the universe with sort of general relativity and the Big Bang gives us. we get back to that interesting point again about, like, you hear be dragons, you know, because you can think about all the crazy ideas that you could come up with, you know, in the future and what people might come up with and anything could come out of it. But at the end of the day, it's finding the best model that fits our observations. And the Big Bang currently is that, including the cosmic microwave background, you know, galaxies moving away from us, the structure of the universe, the fact that it looks the same in all directions as well. So we're sticking with that for now. But you never know, we might get to the Eerby Dragons theory one day.
Yeah, I'm literally crossing my fingers. For the dragon discovery. But Vicky, you have done quite a few videos on this, so where can people find them if they want to hear or watch more?
Yeah, so on my YouTube channel, if you just search for Dr. Becky on YouTube or on Google, it should come up. There's more on sort of this great debate between Big Bang and steady state that we've talked about, more on sort of the nature of the universe, is there a center, that kind of stuff. Done lots of videos on the Big Bang, so check those out.
Perfect. And if you want to send in any questions to us for a future episode, then you can email podcast@ras.ac.uk or tweet @RoyalAstroSoc and we'll take a look. We actually look at every single one, so thank you.
We do.
Now, Robert, as always, what can we see in the night sky this month?
Well, winter stars. This is winter. Obviously, you see the stars of winter, but also, look, it's there's some advantage to having the sky that we've got right now, because we're not able to leave the cities, go out to the countryside if we live in cities. If you're lucky enough to live somewhere dark, obviously it's a different situation. But at this time of year, the sky is dominated by the constellation of Orion, and the stars of Orion are part of a group called the Winter Circle, which is a ring of first magnitude, the brightest stars in the sky around Orion. And for us in the Northern Hemisphere, it's pretty much the brightest sky that we see. So go out and look at that and enjoy it, because even in the inner city, it's pretty obvious. You can see Sirius, the brightest star in the whole sky, if you go down from Orion's belt down to the left. And Betelgeuse, which was speculated last year, it was about to go supernova, which was nobody really quite believed, I think, but it was fading right down. It's back. So top left of Orion, this bright red star is back there again. But if you've got a pair of binoculars, I would recommend, again, given the constraints of going anywhere, have a look at things basically like the moon as well, because it's really high at the moment. It's very dramatic when it's full in January. It's called the Wolf Moon, and it's pretty much as high as it gets in the sky. Or it's when it's at a different phase, you can look for craters in the usual way. And when it's not around, when you've got a slightly darker sky, even in the inner city, you can look for things like star clusters. If you get a star map and you look for Messier's 35, 36, 37, and 38, which are respectively in the constellations of Gemini and Auriga, you pick those out with your binoculars, you'll see at least smudges. And if you've got a small telescope, you'll see they resolve into beautiful clusters of stars. So even in the inner city, that's something that you can pick out. And as ever, we'd love to see your photos of those.
Brilliant. I got some new binoculars for Christmas and a tripod mount as well, because you know what? Those things are heavy and my arm started shaking. I'm like, I'm so weak. I'm so glad I got a tripod mount. But I'm definitely going to use those to look at the things that you just suggested, Robert, definitely for those tips. And also Taylor Pomfret on Twitter asks, what are some of the top astronomical events that we should look out for in 2021, you know, for those of us who got new toys for Christmas?
Well, there's a few things coming up, actually a few months away, that really caught my eye. There's a partial solar eclipse, or visible as a partial solar eclipse, in the UK on the 10th of June. It's actually really well timed. It peaks at 11:30 in the morning. So if we've got good weather and the 10th of June, and the usual caveats that we'll explain nearer the time about protecting your eyes and looking at it safely and so on, about a fifth of the sun will be covered in London and two-fifths up in Shetland. So it's not too bad at all. Now, if we're allowed to travel and you're quite rich, you can go to northern Greenland and see what's called an annular eclipse there, where the sun isn't completely covered, but there's a ring of sunlight around it. And if you've got even more in the way of resources, you can go and see a total eclipse in the Antarctic in December. But that's probably rather more ambitious. As well as that,
great view for the penguins then.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, it'd be a fantastic opportunity. And believe me, I'm more than happy to offer my services as a guide if any travel companies up and running for that. There's also a good meteor shower in August. The Perseids are well placed. That's an annual favourite, but the moon isn't in the sky this year, so that'll be nice in the middle of August. And the most, potentially the most exciting thing is that there might be another brightish comet towards the end of the year. Comet Leonard.
Leonard. And, oh, that's so cute. Hiya, Leonard.
It connects very nicely with the Big Bang Theory, isn't it?
Oh, my God. I love that.
If the weather's clear, it might be visible to the naked eye and certainly good in binoculars. Now, the only caveat I would add to that is that, because you've got to have a lot of caveats in astronomy, is that last year I talked about two comets that both broke up before we then had the wonderful Neowise. Yeah. Neowise is brilliant, but we promoted two comets before that and they broke up. So we never quite know what comets are going to do. It's the whole thing about they're like cats, they've got tails and they do exactly what they do.
Can I ask, why Leonard? Why is it called Comet Leonard?
It's named Comet Leonard because it was discovered by an astrophysicist called Greg Leonard. And if you're lucky enough to find a comet, then you get to name it after yourself. It's one of the few examples. Things like stars, planets, and so on, there's a more complicated process. But comets, you get to name them.
So Comet Leonard, but Greg to his friends.
And also, can I just come into this safe space just to say what went on with the weather for the Great Conjunction?
I know.
I had my checklist of what I was going to take with me. And then on the Sunday, I was like, oh, actually, it's just a really clear sky. I'll nip out and have a nice look and manage that. But didn't give it. It's full time, if I'm going to be honest. And then come Monday, clouds everywhere.
Yeah, I checked the forecast, so I'd done the exact same thing and saw it on Sunday, knowing it was probably the only chance I was going to get. But I did the thing where I knew I needed to be really high to be able to see it, because it was quite close to the horizon. So my garden, there's too many trees. So I was in the spare bedroom and I was like, I'm going to be able to see it from that window. It's fine. But of course, it was so far round that I opened the window. It was practically hanging out. My partner was holding on to me. And then I was like, yeah, I can just about see it now.
Hi, neighbours. You know, don't mind me.
Exactly.
We got lucky, but did exactly the same thing as you're describing, you know, to doing it the night before and showing my daughter. And I did get a photo. I was quite pleased with that because my astrophotos are never amazing. But I did, seeing the two planets together was great. I think, honestly, you're right, though. The weather, it's the UK. And sometimes you just have to say, well, they're only a little bit further apart the day before and the day after. So just take it as it comes.
Yeah, but actually, you know, for those who missed that, though, there is actually another conjunction coming up in February, isn't there, of Venus and Jupiter. Now, we won't be able to see it from the UK because it'd be too low on the horizon. But for those of you, you know, a bit further south, perhaps near the equator or even further south than that, shock horror, you probably have a great view of the conjunction of Venus and Jupiter right before sunrise. Is it February 11th?
February the 11th.
And look out, February 10th, there'll be Jupiter, Venus and Saturn all in a row as well, which I really wanted to see, but we can't see it from the UK.
Very, very, very low for us, I think. Yeah, it's just that that's the advantage of being in the Southern Hemisphere sometimes, isn't it?
Damn those Southern Hemisphere people with their good views.
God damn it. We do have a few listeners, I think, don't we? But yeah, but if they are down.
Well, Jacinda Ardern, of course.
Well, that's it for this month. We'll be back next time with a look at the first stars. And we're going to be bringing back the Space Book Club. So send in your favourite science book recommendations.
Yeah, all the ones you got for Christmas and you've been reading in January to keep you entertained during lockdown. We want to hear all about them. And also send us your questions. It's at Royal Astrosoc on Twitter or email podcast@ras.ac.uk and we'll try and cover them in a future episode. Until then, happy stargazing.